Chet would go after him. I didn't doubt Chet would win that fight, and as satisfying as it would be, I worried what might follow. Chet was 19. If Trigger pressed charges, the matter would be handled in criminal court. I wasn't going to risk tainting Chet's name with a record or sending him behind bars for a little ego-stroking. Trigger gave Innie a hard time at work last week, and I stood up to him, I said. He's just trying to intimidate me. It'll blow over, and he'll forget about it. You'll see. After Chet dropped me off, I went to find Carmina. She sat in a rocker on the back porch, staring into the distance, the line of her mouth pensive. An untouched glass of basil lemonade was perched on her knee. "What is it?" I asked right away. "Is it your heart?"
"No, no, not that. Just thinking. Wishing the summer didn't have to pass so quickly. Every year it goes by faster and faster."
She patted the empty rocker beside hers.
"How was your date with Chet?"
I gave her arm a ribbing poke. "That sounds so old-fashioned." "It was fun. I saw my first real-life ranch with cows and everything. Caught some trouble on the way home, though."
"Oh?
Trigger." She stopped rocking, planting her red cowboy boots firmly on the porch.
"Go on."
"He knows I'm keeping secrets. He threatened to dig around."
"That boy has nowhere to dig," she said decidedly.
"The U.S. Attorney's Office notified the sheriff upon your arrival in town, standard procedure for WITSEC. But he's under strict authority not to disclose anything.
I know the sheriff. He's a good man. Honest and fair. He wouldn't break the law or put you in danger. I'll touch base with him just the same, but I can see this for what it is. Trigger's trying to ruffle your feathers."
"What'd you tell him?"
"I told him I'd kick his ass if he threatened me again."
She sighed, vexed, but I thought I saw a gleam of pride in her eyes.
"That's no way for a lady to behave."
"You're right. Empty threats are very unladylike. I should have just kicked his butt on the spot." This time, she reached out and squeezed my hand.
"Wouldn't we all like to?"
"Carmina, can I ask you a question? It's personal, so I understand if you don't want to answer."
"Hmm?"
"My bedroom? Who did it belong to? Before I came, I mean." For a half second, the soft squeak of the rocking chair halted. Then it started up again, though not quite as slow or steady as before.
"My grandson, Nathaniel."
She took an absent sip of lemonade.
"His favorite color was blue. Bet you couldn't guess."
"You must miss him."
"Oh, I do. He was a firecracker. Told the funniest jokes. Whip smart, too. He'd debate anything with me. Even if he didn't believe his argument, he'd defend it with everything he had, just for the sake of the debate. Was a daredevil, too. Wasn't anything he wouldn't try, so long as he was 50% sure it wouldn't kill him. Once, I came home to find him and Chet."
She broke off abruptly. "What were they doing?" I prompted softly. Her voice heavier and strewn with sorrow, she said,
"They were on the roof, 2 stories up. They were taking turns doing flips off it. They'd pulled one of those big trampolines close to the house and were using it to land on."
Wiping away tears, she chuckled.
"About made me wet my pants. And that while dressed in full police blue."
"I bet you were a good grandmother." Her smile fell away.
"He's dead, Stella. 1 year ago.
"I know."
"Chet?"
"No. One of the women from church. I wanted to hear the truth from you. Do you mind if I ask about Nathaniel's parents?"
"My daughter, you mean."
"Where is she?"
Her face cramped with anguish. "I've made mistakes, Stella. I wasn't a good mother. My daughter abandoned Nathaniel the day he was born. I did right by him, but I failed her. She was 16 years young when she had Nathaniel. She was addicted to horrible things. Drugs, alcohol, boys. I was always at work. My career was important to me. The most important thing. She fell in with the wrong crowd. I punished her. I grounded her. Rules. I enforced every one in the book. I was a cop and a damn fine one. I wanted to make her fall in line. But I never did the one thing she needed. I never listened. I never showed up for her. I was never around. Don't you see? I expected her to grow up just fine without my love. It's no surprise she left. It's no surprise she never came back. I digested her confession slowly. I tried to reconcile this negligent version of Carmina with the strong, clear-headed woman I'd learned to care about so deeply. It was difficult to think Carmina had anything in common with my mom. Absent, unloving, selfish. Those were not words I could imagine using to describe Carmina. It hurt to see any similarity between her and my mom. But the fact that she was being honest made it hard to hold her mistakes against her. How many times would I have forgiven my mom if she'd only told me the truth? Carmina was not the same woman she was describing to me. Stern and duty-driven, yes, but not harsh, callous, and negligent. Unlike my mom, she'd changed. Her past and her future were not the same. "What became of your daughter?" I asked. "Angie? The last time I saw her, she was giving birth to a baby boy. The next morning, the hospital called to say she'd vanished, and what did I want done with the baby? You can't know how many times I've wished she would come back. I need to apologize and make amends. More than that, I need her in my life. But I was never there when she needed me," she brooded into her lemonade. "I'm sorry." "Me too. We've all got our troubles, haven't we?" The phone rang. Carmina started to ease out of her rocker, but I jumped to my feet. "I'll get it." I was trying to help out around the house as much as possible, especially with her weakened heart. I didn't want her back in the hospital. I grabbed the phone in the kitchen. "Songster Residence, Stella speaking." "Estella? Is that you? Is that really you? Oh, baby, I've missed hearing your voice." I went still, utterly still. "Baby, you there? Say something to your mama," she chided me. "I've waited so long to talk to you, I can't wait another minute." Panic fluttered in my throat. I'd made up my mind to call my mom, but on my terms. I hadn't planned for this. Caught off guard, I couldn't control my emotions. I hadn't seen her since the night of the murder. The night I was whisked into the protection of the U.S. Marshals Service and blissfully, blissfully separated from her. I'd managed to all but forget about her. And now here she was, causing months of buried anger and resentment to flash to life in an instant. I found my voice. "Why are you calling?"
"Why on earth do you think, silly?" she went on, her voice as sugary and bubbly as soda. "I'm aching to catch up. Anyway, can't a mama call her baby just because?"
Just because? I didn't believe it for a minute. "I can't talk, I'm busy," I said flatly. Disappointment swept into her voice.
"Too busy for the woman who endured 24 hours of excruciating labor to bring you into the world? They pulled you out with forceps. Most painful thing I've ever endured. Getting a case of the wobbly woos just thinking about it."
"I'm on my way out the door," I said in that same bland tone. "I have to go to work."
"Now, hold on a minute, Estella. I'm not finished. I called for a reason."
"That's more like it."
"What's this nonsense about you testifying against Danny? Those detectives from Philly came to see me. At least one of us was smart enough to tell them to eat dirt."
"You can't do it, Estella. I won't let you. It's dangerous business. The men Danny works with, believe me when I say they aren't to be taken lightly. They're bad men, sweetheart. Real bad. And you let them into our life."
If my remark rattled her conscience, she recovered quickly. It's in everybody's best interest if you tell that frog-faced prosecutor from the federal courts that you're scared silly of Danny, and while you appreciate the government's protection, your life means more to you than their conviction. They're protecting me because I agreed to testify. That was the deal. It's the reason they're protecting you, too. Oh, darling, don't let them hustle you. This is the U.S. government, for crying out loud. They aren't going to leave an itty-bitty 17-year-old girl at the mercy of a powerful cartel, even if you refuse to testify. And that's what you're going to do. Refuse, she said, the last word coming out almost threatening. Do you even care about me? What? What kind of question is that? I'm your mother. What do you think I'm doing? I'm trying to save your life. Has there been one moment during all of this that you actually thought about me first? I asked, my chin trembling. What are you getting at, Estella? She said irritably. If you have something to say, come out with it right now. I'm your daughter. You should be protecting me, not Danny. He doesn't care about you, don't you get it? You were his income source. He let you believe whatever you liked about him because he wanted your money. He didn't love you, I said, my voice pitching higher at the ludicrousness of the idea. How could she not see what I saw? How could she be so desperate and blind? I should have known you'd refuse to listen. She cut me off, sounding flustered and indignant. But beneath that, in some small human way, I heard her shame. For one moment, I thought I might get through to her. Deep down, a part of who my mother once was still struggled to survive, and I clung to it. You never listen, not to me. I did everything for you, gave you the best money can buy. I covered my face with my hand. I swallowed the unwanted and wavering tickle in my throat. It hurt, hearing her gloss over the real issue. Why couldn't she just confess her mistakes? I wanted an apology. I wanted my old mom back. I thought about telling her, but my anger was ebbing away, leaving hollow heartache. I felt completely drained. I said, I can't listen to this. I'm done. Don't call back. You listen to me. Do not testify against Danny. For once in your life, listen to your mama. This is not a man you want to cross. If you step foot in that courtroom, he will find you. He will use every resource in his organization to hunt you down, and he will kill you. He knows people, violent, nasty men. Men she allowed into our life, into my life. Trembling, I hung up. I would not let my mom follow me here, to my haven. I would not let her make me more afraid than I already was. That night, I dreamed of Danny Bilondo. I woke up panting heavily, sweat drenching the back of my nightshirt. I told myself it was just a dream. I was safe here. He'd never find me. But no amount of rational talk could calm my trembling. Light spilled under the door. Stella? Carmina said, knocking lightly. I'm awake. She came in. I heard you cry out. I had a nightmare. Trigger? Danny Bilondo. Still fragile from the heart attack, she lowered herself with care to sit on the bed. As she patted my knee, her fingers were blissfully cool to the touch. Have you talked to anyone about the nightmares? I've heard you cry out more than once. No. I live with them. Would you like to talk to me? I met her eyes. What do you want to know? In my experience, sometimes you have to flush the bad stuff out before you can heal. Getting it out hurts, but it's better than holding on to the poison. I thought about this. I could go back to the beginning. I could tell you about my mom. Carmina spread her hands as if to say the stage was mine. She would listen as long as it took. I don't know how long I sat there, trying to find the right words. I harbored so much anger at my mom, it should have been easy to let it spill out. I felt filled to the brim with that anger, But when confronted with the option of getting it out, it seemed I'd buried it deeper than even I knew. Carmina was right. It was poison. It was in my system. It had taken root. She drank before, at social events, or she'd have a glass of red wine before dinner, I began slowly. But during the divorce, she started drinking a lot, sometimes right after she woke up in the morning. I think she drank to forget how sad she was. I don't think she was still in love with my dad or mourning the loss of him. It was more personal. She saw the divorce as an attack on her, as a personal failure. My dad was cheating on her, and the divorce was his way of saying she wasn't young enough or beautiful enough or good enough for him anymore. How do you know your dad was having an affair? Carmina asked. Affairs, plural. My mom hired a private detective to follow him. There were photographs. She shared them with you? She wanted to hurt him. He wasn't ashamed to admit his indiscretions to her, but she thought he'd be humiliated if I knew. I paused, remembering that awful night when my mom had dragged me out of bed well after midnight. I was already awake, I couldn't sleep through the shouting, and she marched me right up to my dad and shoved the photographs at us, demanding that he explain himself to me. He hadn't. Without looking at me, he walked out, slamming the front door behind him. The next day, he had his assistant come by to collect his clothes and a few other personal belongings. When I agreed to testify against Danny Bilondo for the prosecution, the U.S. Attorney's Office offered to put my dad in WITSEC with me. After all, he was family. He declined. He didn't want to quit his job, and WITSEC doesn't allow you to do the same line of work after you're relocated. They told him I'd never be able to contact him again. Not in person, not through email, nothing. I guess he was okay with that. Carmina guided my head down against her shoulder. She said nothing, but I could feel a change in her breathing. It was slow and deep and troubled. My mom started hanging out with a woman named Sandy Brutzek right after the divorce. My mom complained the only friends she had were the ones she'd met through my dad, and who still moved in his social circles. She wanted to break away from that world and make her own friends. The old friends were polite to her face, but gossiped bitterly behind her back. She was on meds for depression, and when she went out with Sandy and her new friends, she'd come home smelling like pot. Then she started abusing prescription drugs. She and Sandy talked about a dealer they called the pharmacist. I don't know if he was a real pharmacist, but prescription bottles of OxyContin labeled for other people started popping up around our house. She tried to hide them, but I knew. After a while, she stopped talking about the pharmacist, and I stopped finding prescriptions. Somehow, she met Danny. He became her new dealer and gave her heroin. She was really happy at first. In the days after she'd had a night out with friends, she'd laugh and joke with me. She seemed interested in my life. She was depressed, but the drugs masked it. I think she thought they made her the person she wanted to be. Happy, fun, relaxed. But she was none of those things. She was still depressed, and the drugs only distorted her perception of herself for a little while. It was easier for her to drink and do drugs than face her problems and get help, Carmina said. After her initial happiness, things got bad. I tried to get her help. I drove her to the city early every morning to wait in line at the methadone clinics. Methadone was supposed to help her get off heroin. The clinics were in bad parts of the city, and we'd wait outside, in the cold or heat, surrounded by unwashed, desperate-looking people. Sometimes fights would break out in line, and I'd beg my mom to leave, but she had to have enough medicine to get through the day. When the methadone didn't work, she reverted back to heroin. She lost so much weight, she was almost unrecognizable. She stopped eating, showering, or leaving the house except to party with Sandy. She refused to get out of bed unless it was to get more drugs. Over time, her partying isolated her from me. She wasn't there when I needed her. She broke every promise she made. It got to the point that I was so scared I called my grandparents, her parents. That made things worse. She got really angry and wouldn't talk to me. Her parents put her in rehab, but the center told us going in that withdrawal is extremely painful and that she'd probably relapse. She did.
How many times did she go to rehab?
This is her third.
In my whole time as a cop, I only saw a handful of abusers recover. Drugs bring out the bad in people. Sometimes it's hard to remember that addiction is a disease. It doesn't define the person who's suffering. Behind the addiction is a real person, a human who deserves respect.
I shook my head fiercely. Don't take away her accountability. She chose this life. She had me, but she chose drugs. She's a coward, and I don't ever want to be weak like her.
She needs your faith, Stella.
You think I should believe that this time she'll get better? I said, my spine stiffening. Was Carmina listening? This was my mother's third attempt. The longer she stayed on drugs, the harder it was to quit. I'd given up on her. It hurt too much to care. When you cared, you had something to lose, all right.
Before believing comes faith. Before faith comes hope.
I don't want to hope.
Because it hurts?
I couldn't hold the tears back any longer. My lips quivered and my throat burned. When I spoke, my words sounded thick and fragile. It hurts when she lets me down. It hurts knowing drugs are more important to her than me.
It's easier to ignore her. Wish her away. If she doesn't exist, she can't hurt you.
Yes, I choked.
Oh, Stella. My sweet Stella.
She gathered me into her arms and rocked me while I cried. When the worst of my tears had subsided, I said, before she called today, I'd actually given some thought to calling her. Sniffing, I wiped my nose on my sleeve. I thought it would make me feel better to tell her I don't hate her anymore and that I'm ready to move on. I can't decide if that makes me stupid or just naive.
Brave, Stella. That's what it makes you.
I don't want her to think I'm weak or that I caved. She wants me to call back. I don't want to give her what she wants.
What about what you want? Why not look at it that way?
I considered this. I wanted to be brave. I wanted to heal. Most of all, I wanted Carmina to be proud of me. I said, why did you take me in? Why would you do that? You didn't know me. You didn't owe me anything.
Well, she said, the short answer is because they asked me.
The long answer?
I suppose you should know. I was appointed to the U.S. Marshals Service when I was 34. I was getting ready to head to Glencoe, Georgia for basic training. Training was 17 weeks long, and Angie, my daughter, was going to stay with Thomas and Hannah Falconer while I was away. Days before I left, I found out Angie was pregnant. She was 15 and due in 6 months. Well, I stayed. I took care of her. Then I took care of Nathaniel. Never ended up a U.S. Marshal. But I must have stayed on their radar because they called me and said they needed me to take in a girl who'd been placed in witness protection. Keep her safe for the summer.
You sacrificed your own success to take care of your family. And then you gave up your retirement to take me in.
You make me sound like a good woman, Stella. But I figured it out too late.
A few years too late, she echoed. It was hope that kept me afloat in those dark weeks after Angie ran away. Hope that I could change. Hope that she'd someday forgive me. Even though my eyes felt raw, tears surged back. I don't want to hope. I'm terrified my mom will prove me wrong. She's let me down too many times. That night,
The night I went into Witsec, I swore it would be the last.
Tell me about that night. Tell me the worst of it. Get it all out. Tell me, then let it go.
I wanted to tell her. I wanted it more than anything. To let go of the poison and move on, it was all I thought about. But I was afraid. The fear and shame and guilt coiled around me like a snake ready to strike. If Carmina knew what really happened that night, if she learned what I did, I was terrified she wouldn't like me anymore. She'd turn her back on me and hand me over to the authorities.
Before work, I stopped by Radio Shack. After a little searching, I found a cheap, no-frills, pay-by-the-minute phone. The guy working the register scanned the barcode, whistling appreciatively.
Got yourself a real dinosaur here.
I'm on a budget.
You said it. Anything else?
Yeah. How much would a cell phone plan for an iPhone cost?
Looking at around $70 a month.
Is an Android any cheaper?
Same ballpark.
I calculated a rough sum of my saved tips. Maybe it was better to hold off getting a cell phone plan until my birthday, when I left Thunder Basin and settled somewhere permanently. Recently, I hadn't given much thought to how my life would change after I turned 18, but here it was a few days shy of August. I'd served over half my time in Thunder Basin, and while the realization should have thrilled me, I felt a strange pang of misgiving. In 4 weeks, I would be leaving Thunder Basin for good, and I hadn't told Chet. Nor had I discussed my plans with Carmina. I cared about them both, deeply, and didn't look forward to saying goodbye, but the rational part of me knew Thunder Basin wasn't my final destination. Maybe it was the kind of place Stella Gordon could settle in, but changing my name didn't erase Estella Goodwin from my blood. Could I feel complete here? Content? Or was I destined for bigger, better things? I'd always clung to the fantasy of running away with Reed and starting our life over together, of having him nearby to take care of me. But that was no longer an option. Nor was I sure I'd want it if I could have it. This summer had changed me. I wanted to find my own way. At work, we were short-staffed. Innie had called in sick, and Dixie Joe was on the phone frantically trying to reach Deirdre to see if she could help out through the dinner rush.
Any luck? I asked, peeking my head in her office.
No, Dixie Joe rubbed her temples. And this on a Saturday night, of all the bad luck.
I'll do my best to keep up with the cars.
Oh, I know you will. That's not what's bothering me. It's Innie, she admitted. I can't reach her. She called and left the message hours ago telling me she was sick. She left a message on the machine. It isn't like Innie. She'd tell me to my face she wasn't up for a shift. She'd offer to help find a sub. I can't shake the feeling she's avoiding me on purpose. Now why would she do that?
She's due any day now, I reminded her. I had a baby gift at home ready to take to Innie the minute I heard she'd gone to the hospital.
Do you think she went into labor?
Thought of that and called the hospital. She hasn't checked in.
She isn't answering her cell phone. What if she's on some lonely road in the back of her car trying to deliver the baby herself?
Would she do that?
She's worried she can't pay the hospital bills.
Another temple squeeze. She's picked up extra shifts for months now, saving up. Her parents don't support the pregnancy, said they'd have nothing to do with her if she kept the baby, even threatened not to pay the bills. Legally, they'd have to, of course, but it's a matter of pride now. Innie won't accept their help.
If she's afraid she can't afford the hospital, I wouldn't put it past her to deliver the baby in a field. Anything but ask her parents for money. She should have come to me. I told her to come to me.
She wouldn't do that. In the 2 months I'd known Innie, I'd never seen her ask for help. Even with swollen ankles and her belly protruding to the point where she looked like she'd swallowed a beach ball,
She refused to sit down for a breather at the end of the night and let me fill her salt and pepper shakers. She was bound and determined to do everything herself.
"Foolish girl," Dixie Joe snapped. She pushed out of her chair, pacing the office. "Stubborn, pig-headed girl."
A tear trickled down her cheek. "I need to be alone, Stella. I need to think where she'd go to have this baby. I can help you look, now or after my shift. Just tell me what you want me to do." I was worried about Innie, too, especially now that I knew more about her situation. If her parents weren't on board with the baby, Innie would have turned her back on the idea of asking them for help long ago. No matter how desperate, she'd do this on her own, even if it killed her.
"I appreciate that," Dixie Joe said, grief weighing heavily on her face. "But I'm worried either way will be too late."
After work, I found a note under the windshield wiper of Carmina's truck. It was from Chet, and the news he had to deliver didn't lighten my mood. Dusty hadn't shown up for work today. Chet had been at the ranch until sundown and hadn't played the message Dusty's boss left on his phone until late. Worse, Dusty had raided the emergency stash of money Chet kept in the house. It was gone, all of it. Chet was out looking for him and would call me at Carmina's the minute he knew something. I didn't want to think bad of Dusty, but I had a hunch he was feeling desperate to get his business with Cooter started, even if it meant cheating his brother. It was hard not to draw a parallel with my mom. Only once, but still once, she stole money from me to fund her habit. The cash was in my wallet before I went to bed. She went partying with Sandy, and in the morning, the money was gone. She might have stolen again had I not learned to hide my money. I'd fallen asleep with the window open, tempting any trace of a breeze inside my bedroom, and the deep rumble of the Scout pulled me instantly awake. In the dark, I tugged on a pair of shorts and hurried downstairs. Chet climbed out of the truck, his movements heavy, his shoulders hunched and his eyes dead. He was looking at me, but he didn't seem to see me. He stood, dazed and blinking, almost like he was lost. Right away, I knew it was Dusty. Something horrible had happened. "Chet?" I slipped my feet into Carmina's garden clogs and jogged down the porch steps. The night air was thick and hot, but the look on Chet's face chilled me to the core, and I wished I'd brought something to wrap around my shoulders. "It's Dusty, isn't it?" He sank down on the driveway. He leaned his head back against the Scout. His face, which had always appeared strong and certain to me, reflected sheer exhaustion.
"He spent it. All of it. His college savings. The money he earned this summer. Our emergency fund. Nearly $5,000. Gone."
"Drugs?" I asked quietly.
He laughed sharply, and the ice in his tone made me shiver again.
"I wish he'd blown it on drugs. Drugs he could sell. Drugs would be profitable. He used the money to hire a midwife. His girlfriend was pregnant. I didn't even know he had a girlfriend."
Now it was my turn to blink. I stared into near space, her name rolling involuntarily off my tongue. "Innie."
"They're keeping the baby. Did you hear me? They're keeping the baby," he shouted angrily. "Don't tell me I should be grateful he did the responsible thing. For once, I don't want him to be responsible. I want him to be selfish, like I'm being now."
"Have you tried talking to him?"
"He told me they couldn't afford the hospital, so they hired a midwife. He said they're keeping the baby, and the minute those words sank in, I started yelling sense at him. I told him he was putting the baby up for adoption, or I'd kick him out. He hung up."
Chet's breath heaved in and out, his eyes dark and blazing.
"He doesn't want to listen, but he knows I'm right. If he keeps the baby, it's over. He'll never go to college. He'll stay here, plastering pools until his back gives out, and then he'll get a job on the railroad in North Platte. It's not what my parents wanted."
He scrubbed his hands through his hair.
I'm not cut out for this. I failed. I let everyone down. This is why Dusty wanted to partner with Cooter Sagari, to support his girlfriend and their kid. I never saw it. I was oblivious. And now it's too late. Everything is falling down around me.
I didn't know what to say. I took his face in my hands and tipped his forehead to mine. My hands were steady, but I felt my strength start to crumble. What Chet hadn't said, but knew as well as I did, was that if Dusty couldn't support the baby like he thought he could, Chet would step in. He was angry now and threatening to kick Dusty out, but he wouldn't. When he calmed, he'd accept that he was Dusty's guardian and he'd see this through, at the expense of his own future and dreams. "Oh, Chet," I said, feeling my heart break for him.
"Her parents already kicked her out," he said roughly. "She doesn't have anywhere to go. If she'll give up the baby, they'll take her back."
"She won't do that." His eyes found mine, and they were swimming with bewilderment.
"Does she have any idea what it's like to be a parent? Dusty said he knows it won't be easy, but he has no idea what's in store. It isn't that it isn't easy. It's that it's the hardest thing he'll ever do. He isn't ready. He thinks he is, but he's a kid. He hasn't lived his own life, so how is he going to take care of someone else's?"
I held him tighter. I didn't have answers, but the last thing he needed right now was to feel alone. I could give him that, at least. My companionship and a listening ear.
"I told Dusty she couldn't live with us," Chet said, his tone morose. "I laughed when he suggested it. I called him a fool and a few other things. I told him, 'Don't show up at the house with her or the baby, because I won't let you in.' Here's true irony," he went on. "This week at work, we were castrating bulls, and I'm not usually squeamish, but I took a moment to wince. Feel a bit sorry for them, you know? And then, this happened with Dusty, and my first thought was, 'Nope, castration isn't a bad thing at all. Apply it to humans.'"
He was aiming to amuse me, but I couldn't bring myself to laugh.
"I'm going to let her move in, aren't I?" he realized quietly. "I don't know if it's the right thing or the worst idea I've ever had, but I'm scared out of my mind that I'm going to go through with it and let her and the baby live with us."
"What would your mom have done?" While I waited for his answer, I asked myself the same question. What would my mom have done if Reed had gotten me pregnant? It didn't matter. I would have run away with him. I would have moved out, not staying long enough to see her reaction, because the reality of the situation was that she wouldn't have cared. That's what drugs did. They took away your ability to care about anything but more, more, more drugs.
"If I don't take her in, Dusty will drop out of school and get a full-time job. He'll have to take care of rent, food, bills, all of it. His life will stop here."
"All probably true." He sighed again, but this time his body relaxed, and I guessed that meant he had his answer. "I'm here to help, you know," I said. I rested my cheek against the slope of his shoulder. He smoothed my hair absently and let go a rueful sigh.
"What did I ever do to deserve this?"
"You gave Carmina hell," I said, smiling faintly. "Some might call this karma." He pulled back, looking at me directly.
"I meant you. What did I do to deserve you, Stella? I've made mistakes. I've screwed up enough times. So how does a guy like me end up with you?"
There was genuine wonder and amazement in the way he looked at me. And if I thought I'd known guilt before, I was wrong. When he guided my head against his chest, I drew a quiet but deep breath. I had to tell him I was leaving Thunder Basin. I couldn't hold off any longer. A few days later, I was kneeling in Carmina's rose beds, absorbing myself in the mindless task of pulling weeds while I worked up the courage to call my mom back and tell her. First, that I was going to testify, and second, that I didn't hate her anymore. After hanging up on her during our last call, I'd sworn I'd never speak to her again. But that was the poison talking. It wanted to stay rooted inside me and turn me black with bitter rage. I had to call her, this time on my terms. I had to exorcise the past and move on. I'd never forgiven anyone, not officially like to a priest in a confessional, and was having a hard time figuring out how to balance what I wanted her to hear with what I wanted her to feel. I didn't want her walking away from our conversation feeling excused for her behavior or without guilt. I supposed I wanted her to know I wasn't going to let her hurt me anymore. But if she wanted to kick herself over her bad choices, so be it. Carmina wouldn't approve, but I had to start somewhere. Maybe down the road I'd decide to fully forgive my mom. I still didn't believe in God, but it made sense that if there was a supreme ruler of the universe, he wouldn't expect these kinds of harbored emotions to be dropped in an instant. Forgiveness took time, I decided. It was a process. Better to start slowly than not at all. I heard the scout approaching down the road. Rocking back on my heels, I peeled out of my garden gloves just as Chet angled into the drive.
"You busy?"
he asked, hanging his arm out the driver's side window. His cowboy hat was tipped low, shading his eyes, which sparkled mischievously.
"You're in a good mood. Agree to come with me and make it even better."
"What do you have in mind?"
"Ever been to a rodeo?
Like cowboys and clowns?" A smile danced at his mouth.
"Yeah, and bull riding, steer roping, chuck wagon racing, and mutton busting."
"No," I said cautiously. None of the above sounded like my thing, even if half the words were foreign.
"Hop in."
He inclined his head at the seat next to him.
"You're about to get a culture lesson."
"See, I don't think you know what the word culture means." "Where's Dusty?" I asked, playing for time.
"At the house with his girlfriend and the baby. Come on, time's a-wasting."
Innie had moved in with Dusty and Chet over the weekend. I'd stopped by to visit and deliver a gift for the baby, a girl they'd named Beatrix. But Innie had been asleep. I was dying to talk with her and catch her up on the latest gossip from the sundown. "I don't know," I hedged further. It wasn't that I didn't want to hang out with Chet, but a rodeo? Weren't rodeos consistently getting panned by animal rights activists? Plus, I had visions of fried bull testes being sold alongside churros and funnel cakes out of a dirty food truck.
"You're overthinking this," he said,
smiling at my expression, which must have appeared deeply conflicted. "No bull testes," I finally said.
"Final offer." "Deal."
"And if it rains, we seek shelter." Dark clouds cloaked the horizon, but the evening sun blazed hot overhead. And while I hadn't seen rain in the forecast, I needed to cover my bases.
"No wet t-shirt contest today. You got it."
"Carmina's at the store. Let me change clothes and leave a note for her." Inside, I zipped myself into my yellow sundress, left a note for Carmina on the kitchen counter, and snagged 2 chilled Cokes from the fridge. "Am I wearing proper rodeo attire?" I asked Chet, twirling in a circle. I'd paired the sundress with the boots Carmina had given me.
"You look like a local."
I tossed him a Coke and climbed in.
"I have to drop off some rodeo gear first, but it shouldn't take long," Chet said, reversing down the drive. "Milton Swope referred me to a neighbor who has a couple saddle and bareback bronc riders competing tonight. I'm delivering their gear."
30 minutes later, we pulled up behind the rodeo arena. Trucks and horse trailers clogged the dusty, rutted road looping the arena. We were opposite the stands, and I could see they were starting to fill, even though the rodeo didn't start for another half hour. As Chet drove past the loading chutes, he pointed to a string of cowboys stretching their legs.
Those are the bareback bronc riders warming up. Have to tie their spurs, do squats to stretch the groin, and, of course, chew tobacco, drink beer, and talk trash to the other riders.
What are they crushing in their gloves?
Rosin. They rub it quickly along the rope they are going to use to ride to make it tacky.
They look nervous.
Some of that, sure. But mostly concentrating. Running through best and worst case scenarios in their head. Dreaming of the purse. There's nearly $100,000 up for grabs tonight.
Wow. It was more than I would have guessed from small town entertainment. Next, we drove past the bullpen. The gates were high, but I caught a glimpse of black hide stretched over meaty haunches and sharp horns. How does bull riding work? I asked. You said Sydney's boyfriend is a bull rider. Is he here?
Might be. If there's one rodeo sport I wouldn't try, it's bull riding. Too risky. When I was a kid, I saw a rider's leg right up near the groin skewered by a bullhorn. That tempered my curiosity real fast. But it's an exciting sport to watch. A ride is scored from 0 to 100 points. Anything above 75 is impressive. A rider has to stay mounted on the bull for 8 seconds to get any points. If he falls off, the bull gets the points. If the rider touches the bull, the rope, or himself with his free hand, the hand you always see a rider holding in the air, he's disqualified.
I always thought riders held up a hand for balance.
Riders are judged on style and control. Things like synchronizing their movement to the bull's and on how the bull performs. If the bull is unusually aggressive and gives the rider a hard time, extra points are awarded. After 8 seconds, a loud buzzer sounds and the rider can jump off.
I'd seen pictures of cowboys in chaps and boots, their bodies twisting and convulsing like a rag doll on the back of a bucking bull. I was with Chet. Probably not something I wanted to try anytime soon. Chet parked a distance from the bucking chutes and unloaded a couple of boxes from the back of the scout. Can I help? I offered.
Nah, it'll be less than 10.
After he disappeared, I propped my boots on the dash and watched the bull riders stretch in the rearview mirror. I wish I'd thought to grab the cowgirl hat Chet had given me. I could have taken a country selfie with the bullpen directly behind me. But since I didn't use social media anymore, the government had shut down my accounts, it wasn't like I could post the picture anywhere. And there was that whole issue of not having a phone with a camera. I took the pay-by-the-minute phone out of my purse and turned it over in my hands. I still didn't know exactly what I was going to say to my mom. Even once I came up with a script, I was afraid I'd abandon it in favor of yelling, or worse, crying. For days now, I'd searched for the right words, but I was beginning to accept that this wasn't the kind of conversation you could rehearse. I was never going to settle on the perfect lines. Maybe it was time for a new approach. Dive in and have faith the words would flow when I needed them. I could call her now, while I waited for Chet. With the help of a deep breath, I dialed the number for the detox clinic. Before I could squash the butterflies in my stomach, a receptionist answered. "Savannah Gordon, please," I said, since Carmina had told me that the DOJ had given my mom the same last name I was going by, Gordon. "One moment." After a pause, her voice came back on the line. "I'm sorry, Savannah Gordon is no longer with us."
"What?"
"She checked herself out this morning." "That can't be right. There must be a mistake. Check again." "It's right here in her file. She voluntarily left the program."
"Where did she go?"
"Patients aren't required to leave that information." "Miss, there's another call coming in. Would you mind holding?"
"Yes, I'd mind," I snapped. "I need to know where Savannah went."
I knew getting upset wouldn't help, but I was too shell-shocked to be polite. Had my mom only left rehab, or had she left witness protection too? I knew WITSEC was voluntary, and she could leave at any time. But surely she wasn't stupid enough to return to her old identity. Was the U.S. Attorney's Office aware of what she'd done?
It isn't our policy to track patients after they leave the program, the receptionist said stiffly.
Gee, thanks for the help, I said and hung up. I stared into near space, dazed. Why would my mom leave rehab? Because she needed drugs. It was the reason she always left. And if she returned to drugs, she'd returned to Philly. I couldn't believe she'd do something this dangerous. Had she given any thought to the risks? If Danny's men found her, they'd kill her. It didn't matter that she wasn't cooperating with authorities. Danny didn't know that, and he certainly didn't love her. Was chasing the next high worth her life? Had she spared a single moment to consider how her recklessness might affect me? It stood to reason the U.S. Attorney's Office had told her my new name, Stella Gordon. If Danny's men got her high, she might give me up. They could string it right out of her. I didn't want to think she'd betray me sober, but I wasn't sure. When it came to my mom, nothing was certain. I had to think. Now that Danny was behind bars, who would she call when she got to Philly? Sandy. If my mom was back in Philly, Sandy would know. My mom would want to party with her. I'd been warned not to contact anyone from my former life, but I wasn't going to sit back and let my mom get herself killed. And I wasn't going to let her put me at risk. I slowed my racing thoughts deliberately. I had to be smart about this. Danny Bilondo's gang could be watching Sandy, hoping my mom would eventually reach out to her. Deputy Price had told me it would be one of Danny's, and the cartel's, if they were backing him, strategies to keep an eye on our family and close friends, waiting patiently for us to slip up and contact them. I had to be very, very careful. I couldn't raise even a hint of suspicion. Reed had once told me the best way to avoid having a call traced was to use a disposable prepaid phone, because they could only be tracked when turned on. I knew calling Sandy wasn't completely risk-free, but I could greatly reduce my chances of being caught if I turned the phone off and trashed it immediately after using it. To find me, Danny Bilondo's gang would have to be monitoring Sandy's calls. They'd have to recognize my voice, and they'd have to know what phone I was calling from. The odds were on my side. Not completely in the bank, but on my side. Feeling a pounding of nerves, I called Sandy. Her number was fresh in my mind. Back in Philly on the nights when my mom didn't come home, I knew to call Sandy. They were always together. If they hadn't passed out, one or the other could usually give me an address. Then it was up to me to find my mom and drag her home. I shut my eyes, feeling tears slip through my lashes. It hurt to remember. "Hello?" Sandy answered, sounding cranky but sober. "May I speak to Sandy Brusick?" I affected a slightly deeper voice, but I wasn't worried she'd recognize me. We'd only talked a handful of times. Sandy hadn't visited our home frequently. I'd known from the first time I met her that she had no interest in me. "Who is this?" she wanted to know. "My name is Mary Dutton. I'm responsible for several accounts owned by Savannah Goodwin, and I've had trouble reaching her. She listed you as her primary contact. Would you be willing to provide her most current contact information?"
"You a debt collector?"
I didn't know if real debt collectors had to be upfront, but I didn't have to follow the same rules. "I'm with Keystone Financial Services. There have been some important updates made to Savannah's accounts that will affect future transactions. It's very important that I notify her."
"Why would Savannah list me?" Sandy demanded, sounding more irritated.
"Part of my job is to track her down, and until I have her most current phone number and address, I'll have to keep calling this number." That seemed to give her food for thought. She didn't pause long before saying, "Yeah, all right. I can give you her new number. Lucky you called when you did. I haven't heard from Savvy in months, but she rang this morning. Hang on a sec. Here it is. Ready?
Ready. I tried to sound calm and not overly anxious.
Area code 215. I scribbled down the entire number, repeated it back, then ended the call. The next call was harder to make. When my mom answered, it was going to take all my willpower not to yell. I was furious and disgusted. But if I wanted her cooperation, I was going to have to keep my cool. If I kept my head, maybe she would too. Maybe I could reason with her and talk her back to rehab. The phone rang and rang. With each passing moment, I felt my anger drain and worry fill its place. What if something had already happened? I stepped out of the scout, pacing in front of it. A few raindrops splashed my arms, but the sky looked like it would hold. Chet was taking an awfully long time. I could hear the rodeo announcers in the distance introducing the lineup of ropers. Sitting on the bumper, I forced my nerves to settle. I wasn't going to panic until I had a reason to. My mom could be too high to answer her phone.